It's Lynn Rossetto Casper with The Splendid Table. One reason eating vegetarian is a romp instead of a dirge is something that happened in San Francisco some 20 years ago. A group of Buddhists opened Greens, the restaurant. It was the first eatery to turn the vegetable into serious, fabulous eating. And it's still going strong. Today we talk with Green chef Annie Somerville. Now, on the other hand, the Sterns are tracking the aroma of sausage in Portland, Oregon. Then it's smoking your supper. Dory Greenspan talks chips, chunks, and planks. And we have a fictional tale of the Vietnamese cook to Alice B. Toklas and Gertrude Stein. All this and your calls coming up on The Splendid Table. But first, this.
You were the woman in the blue mask, standing there beside your dress. All the things I wanted from you, I never could express. I thought I saw you once in Munich, but you slipped away. I'm in the corner with a coffee at the Dream Cafe. When you turn from the window, you won't outslip and put your eyes to my fingers while the ceiling dripped. I just could not leave you. I heard a motorcycle pull away. Yes, I'll meet you after midnight at the Dream Cafe. Flowers now on Lynn Street and a new moon just above. They tore down all the houses where we used to make love. But they'd been long abandoned when we went there anyway. And I can still smell the lilacs in the corner of the Dream Cafe. We've only been fighting 10 years. Do you really have to go? Couldn't you reconsider and do it real, real slow? I like living with you. I don't care what you say. I don't care who you meet at the Dream Cafe. Your eyes roll back at midnight, lost in a fantasy. I heard you cry out someone's name, and maybe it was me. But later, as we're walking, you seem so far away. Am I the man you thought you met at the Dream Cafe? I come down with the sickness. I thought you were the cure. But passion seems to promise more than friendship can endure. You spelled it out in black and white. My eyes saw shades of gray. And so I sit alone tonight
at the Dream Cafe. Lightning in the mirror, and the thunder cries out loud. I could be to you, and you could be to me, just another face in the crowd. The plane don't leave till midnight. Come with me today. There'll be plenty of time to be alone at the Dream Cafe.
It's Lynn Rossetto Casper, and you're listening to The Splendid Table, the show for people who love to eat. Our program is produced by Minnesota Public Radio and brought to you by Super Target. Well, today, it's the story behind the first restaurant to make veggies serious and fabulous eating. We talk with the guiding force behind an American classic, Green's Restaurant in San Francisco. Our guest is Green chef Annie Somerville. Food expert Dory Greenspan has a guide to chips, chunks, and planks. It's all about smoking your supper. Then it's Revenge at the Breakfast Table with Alice B. Toklas and Gertrude Stein when Monique Truong reads from her novel, The Book of Salt. And as always, in the second half of the show, we are going to be opening the lines for your calls. Reach us at 800-537-5252. So let's roll with Jane and Michael Stern. They write the Road Food column for Gourmet Magazine.
Lynn, we were driving along Southeast Woodstock Avenue in Portland, Oregon, and we started smelling something really, really delicious. We stopped at Otto's Sausage Kitchen, and we met the proprietor who told us what exactly we were smelling.
Hello, I'm Jerry Eikentoff, and we're here at Otto's Sausage Kitchen in Portland, Oregon. This is the old smokehouse that grandfather built, and we use alder wood. And it's impermeated into all the walls, and people can smell it for blocks away.
And what kind of stuff do you smoke with that alderwood?
Our old-fashioned hot dogs and the German Oktoberfest sausage are our two main products. But we do fish, jerky, we've smoked luau pigs, you name it, smoked turkeys, we've done it.
This is a man who will throw anything on a grill and make it taste delicious.
Do they actually serve food there?
Yes, we sat outside the little market on plastic chairs and tables on the corner, smoke from the grill wafting, billowing all through the air. And this is such a neighborhood, it's such a Portland institution that a woman named Diane Chafin, who's one of our Road Food readers, sent us a tip about this place a few years ago. And she said, when I moved to Portland, she said, the real estate agent kept telling me about this neighborhood has good schools and this neighborhood, you know, has gentrified buildings. And she said, you know, I really don't care about good schools or anything. I just want to live near Otto's. So I think people in Portland are, you know, completely wild about this place that's been there for generations.
It is mostly a market, and they have all of these smoked meats there, and they have all kinds of, you know, deli products. And really about the only thing that they prepare to eat are these sausages that are cooked outside on the sidewalk on this grill that just perfume the neighborhood. And they're really, I mean, to call them hot dogs is really not doing them justice. I mean, these are homemade, delicious sausages, two or three different kinds, on buns with the usual condiments. It's a real special eating experience.
Because the heart of Otto's is that it's a butcher shop. So, you know, it's the best kind of butcher shop, like almost the barbecue places in Texas that started out as butcher shops and then went on to be, you know, to smoke what they had left over and it became barbecue. Otto's does that with their homemade sausage and hot dogs. And boy, it really tastes like homemade.
Do they do salmon too? Because, you know, when you think of alderwood smoking in the Northwest, you think salmon.
When we were there talking to Jerry Eikentoff, he had some salmon that he personally had caught that morning that he had cut into pieces and was about to go into the smoker. It was beautiful, bright pink, just the most beautiful fish I've ever seen, and he was about to smoke it that day.
I think it was really, truly the best salmon that we had when we were out in Portland. I mean, you know, you can really have salmon mania out there, and I think we had everything, including somebody made a salmon ice cream that we tasted.
Not a good idea.
But this was the most... It was delicious, but also the most visually beautiful piece of food that I've seen in the Pacific Northwest.
The thing that I'm interested in, though, is, I mean, he said his grandfather built this place, so they've been doing this for such a long time.
It's a real fixture in that neighborhood, and it's a neighborhood with a few other stores there, but it's not downtown. It's a real kind of casual, almost old-world-feeling place. The fact that you actually sit out on the sidewalk... I guess that's not unusual to New Yorkers, but in Portland, it is unusual. It's a very special place.
There's a lot of working men who sort of just take lunch there routinely. When Otto's really gets their grills cranking up, I mean, they literally create traffic jams along Woodstock Avenue, which is where they're situated. It's such a come-hither smell that, you know, cars kind of become like bumper cars when that hot dog aroma gets wafting through the air.
And I should mention that along with these terrific grilled sausages, they have a big cooler full of regional beers that really go very good with these hot dogs and sausages.
So this can be a deep intellectual investigation.
For a long afternoon, yes.
Thanks, guys.
Bye, Lynn.
Bye-bye, Lynn.
Stick shifts and safety belts, bucket seats have all got to go when we're driving in the car. It makes my baby seem so far. I need you here with me, not way over in a bucket seat. I need you to be here with me, not way over in a bucket seat.
Jane and Michael Stern's newest book in their road food series is Louie's Backyard Cookbook. Now, Jane Stern's newest book is Ambulance Girl. Now, every week the Sterns come by with a report, but you can get their food finds anytime. Just go to the website, splendidtable.org. And while you're there, sign up for our free weekly newsletter. It's called Weeknight Kitchen. It's our humble attempt to streamline your life in the kitchen after 5 o'clock. Every week we send you a new recipe for a quick weeknight supper. You've got technique tips and shopping information. And it is free. All you have to do is sign up, splendidtable.org. Although food authority Dory Greenspan writes award-winning cookbooks, she also has a penchant for checking out kitchen equipment. Her Tools of the Trade column appears each month in Bon Appetit magazine, and she comes by the Splendid Table regularly to share her latest discoveries. Hey, Dory, welcome back.
Hi there.
So what have you been working on?
I've taken up smoking again.
You're kidding.
Having given it up years ago, I'm smoking, but this time I'm doing it with the grill. This has really been fun. I've been using wood chips and chunks to add a smoky flavor to food that I've cooked on the grill. These are wood chips are, well, the chips are about the size of kind of mulchy or the shards. Mm-hmm. And the chunks are bigger, some as big as a lemon. And you can use them in all kinds of flavors. They're, you know, oak or mesquite or maple or hickory, to add a flavor to food that you've got on the grill. You can't go chopping up your old pine paneling. You need to use hardwoods. Any soft wood will have a resin in it, and that'll really ruin your food.
Mm.
But you can buy ready-to-go chips and chunks, and you can soak them, which is really a good thing to do before you use them. Soak them in water, in wine, in beer, in cider, which would give it another flavor. And you can either toss them over the charcoal or the lava rocks if you've got a gas grill.
Mm-hmm.
A little messy, but it works. Or your grill may have a smoke box, or you can buy a smoke box, a heavy metal box, a cast iron box with a slotted top. You can put the soaked chips in that. Or you can make a little pouch out of aluminum foil and puncture some holes in it. And then put that directly on top of the rocks or the coals. And the longer you cook something, the more smoke flavor you'll get for it.
Do you actually taste the difference from one wood to another?
You know, you taste, if you use a very strong wood like mesquite, you taste it. For me, the woods like pecan or oak or maple, it's hard to taste one from the other doing it this way.
Mm-hmm.
But it's really, it's fun. It's also, once you get this technique down, there's not much to it. You can use dried herbs. You can use grapevines. And the smell, as much as the flavor, it's also just this great aroma of this smoke. I've really enjoyed using it. And you can get a lot of you can get the chips and the chunks online from naturesownonline.com. And it's about $6 for 2 pounds of chips and chunks.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I've also found that you can get a really good smoke taste and smell indoors using a stovetop smoker. Have you ever used one?
Are those, they look like a metal box. They're not very
exactly.
big. And you put
They're
things in the
They're not very
bottom?
Big. Exactly. You put kind of smoker dust, again, in all the wood varieties, in the bottom of the smoker, heat it up. And that, because it's such a small container and so enclosed, you get a really very, very smoky flavor.
Dory, you see recipes, a lot of recipes, using planks of wood. What's that about?
That's such an old method of cooking, still very, very popular in the Pacific Northwest. It's a Native American way of cooking. And the planks are, in fact, that, planks of wood, usually cedar or alder or oak. Where I am in Connecticut, we have planked shad and planked bluefish festivals.
Mm-hmm.
And so the fish goes directly on the plank, and the plank goes either in your oven, in your fireplace, kind of along the side wall of the fireplace, standing up, or in your barbecue. And it's a great, great way of getting wood flavor into food, particularly fatty fishes, salmon, bluefish, mackerel, shad. And you can get thick planks that will probably last a lifetime. They're about $40 or $50. Or you can get sets of very, very thin planks, one to a fish fry.
Mm-hmm.
And they're disposable, and 6 planks for about $15 or so. And there's a great website for that, plankcooking.com.
It's pretty direct. But how do you, if you're standing up the plank and you've got the fish on the plank, how do you keep the fish on the plank? Do you have to nail it in?
Actually, I've seen it nailed in.
Oh, okay.
I've seen it nailed in. That's the way they do them in the planking festivals, you know, near us. I've used the plank in the oven, and I've just put some bacon over the fish so that there's some added flavor and fat over it.
Mm-hmm.
It's really pretty yummy.
That sounds great. Hey, Dory, thank you.
You're welcome.
Dory Greenspan's latest book is Paris Sweets. Her equipment column, Tools of the Trade, appears in Bon Appetit magazine. You know, smoky things beg for big accents, like chutneys. Now, there's this basic formula, and you just keep doing riffs on it with what's in season. The formula is this. Start out with a distinctive ingredient, like fruit or onion, corn, chili. Then you flavor. You use sweet, sour, and you use spice. Now, the sweet could be hoisin sauce, fruit syrups, honey, or obviously sugar. Sour could be citrus, vinegar, or tamarind, which is great because it's fruity, but it's tart. And by the way, you can get it jarred in Middle Eastern and Asian groceries. Now, spicing could be anything that you like, and you can always finish it off with yogurt or sour cream. So start out with this improvisation for a fruit chutney. Slice up peaches or nectarines. Toss them with a little bit of that tamarind concentrate, some honey, fresh basil, red onion, and a shot of Tabasco. So, go out and improvise. Coming up, the restaurant that started a paradigm shift in the way we eat. Gertrude Stein reaps revenge on Alice B. Toklas via her cook. And open lines for your calls. You can reach us at 800-537-5252. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You're listening to The Splendid Table, produced by Minnesota Public Radio and distributed by PRI. Thank you. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper, and this is The Splendid Table, the show about life's appetites. The Splendid Table is brought to you by SuperTarget, a grocery store and Target all in one, where guests can have their cake and a plate to eat it on, too. Online at target.com/SuperTarget. Now, most people don't track these things, but we've seen a profound shift on our dinner plates. It's no accident that farmers markets and heirlooms are booming. The vegetable has gone from an afterthought to a star. Now, we're talking vegetables so good you never miss the meat. The shift began in 1979 when a restaurant opened in San Francisco. It was called Greens, it served no meat, and it turned the vegetable into multi-starred cuisine. Annie Somerville has been executive chef at Greens for 18 years. I think of her as a quiet revolutionary. Her new book is Everyday Greens. Annie, welcome.
Thank you very much.
Annie, tell us how Greens began.
Well, Greens was began as part of the Zen Center and was one of Zen Center's numerous businesses, and really came out of the cooking that we did. Perhaps I could say started with the cooking at Tassajara, which is Zen Center's monastic retreat center. And we were so successful at that that the next step was to open the Tassajara Bread Bakery mm-hmm. in San Francisco. And then from there, Greens took the next step. And I don't think anybody realized at the time what a star Greens would become.
Well, how does Buddhism play into the food at the restaurant?
Well, that's a wonderful question. I think that if we look back to the very earliest days of Greens, when we opened in 1979 and when everyone working there was part of the Zen Center supporting the Zen community, we could say that the spirit in the kitchen and the way we went about working was definitely a reflection of our Zen practice and probably, I think we could say, the practice of mindfulness, and also in the spirit of making good food and just serving guests and taking care of them. And over the years, the restaurant's evolved, and now there's just a handful of us who are still closely connected to the Zen Center, though that spirit still pervades, because for those of us who have been there since the early days, that's just the way we learn to cook, and that's the way we think about serving our guests.
But how does that happen in a kitchen? I mean, restaurant kitchens can get pretty chaotic.
Restaurant kitchens are very chaotic, and I will say that, honestly, that Greens has many, many chaotic moments, and I always walk in the door completely ready for anything to happen, and I'll say that nothing ever surprises me. And I think that if you make a correlation between the Buddhist practice of mindfulness, which is bringing one's hopefully calming meditation experience into everyday life and into the workplace, that would be similar to a very well-run, professionally-run kitchen.
You know, I wonder, so many people look at non-meat food as being a way not only to eat vegetables, but a way of not eating meat. You know, there's almost a negative side to it.
Yes.
Was there a problem in the beginning? I mean, people coming in and expecting something that if it wasn't meat, it was like meat?
Well, I think there was a little of that. However, I think that people were just so amazed by the fact that they could have these great, delicious, beautiful dishes that happened to be made without meat. We weren't looking for the meat substitute, and we weren't trying to talk about the meat substitute. We were just presenting vegetables and delicious dairy products and nuts and oils all combined on a plate that made beautiful dishes that tasted delicious. And I think that's the positive side of mm-hmm. it. We were not, and we never have, and I hope that we never do try to look for that meat substitute. I don't think it's necessary.
What was it like for you putting together a cookbook? Because it's a very different thing than running a restaurant.
Yes, it is. there is a huge difference between, one, writing a cookbook and being a restaurant chef, and then mm-hmm. how people cook at home. So it was really a decision of just selecting the dishes that worked and then going through and testing them over and over again, making sure that the directions were clear and also that the book was fun to use and that, you know, people feel invited to jump in and use the recipes and cook at home, and also to use the recipes as a starting point, really a launching point for saying, okay, well, here's this dish with white beans and now I know how to make this, and, you know, I could do these other things now and I have a little confidence to do that.
Thank you so much, Annie.
You're very welcome.
Annie Somerville is executive chef of Greens Restaurant in San Francisco and author of Everyday Greens. Now, you can get her recipe for grilled fingerling potato salad with corn and cherry tomatoes. Doesn't that sound good? Anyway, you can get it on the website, splendidtable.org. Novelist Monique Truong is fascinated with the lives of Alice B. Toklas and Gertrude Stein. In the Paris of the 1920s, these two Americans created a salon that brought together extraordinary talents, the likes of Picasso and Hemingway. Truong took a note in Alice B. Toklas's papers about advertising for a cook and having a Vietnamese man answer, and spun it into an imagined picture of their lives as seen through the eyes of that cook. The novel is The Book of Salt. I think of it as a portrait of a man who has always been on the outside.
Gertrude Stein is up early this morning. A rare, and for me, an unwelcome occurrence. She wants an omelette, says Miss Toklas, who busies herself with the plates, silverware, and tray. 6 eggs beaten with a generous pinch of salt, until the mixture is thick with air, until the color lightens to the bare yellow of chamomile centers. 2 large soup spoons of butter, the first melted in the pan until it sizzles, a harmonic of anticipation. A simple dish that reveals the master, exposes the novice. My omelets are well regarded and held in high esteem by all those who have partaken. Like children gullible and full of wonder, they always ask, "What is your secret?" Do I look like a fool? I ask myself each time. Please, madam, do not equate my lack of speech with a lack of thought. If there is a secret, madam, I would take it with me to my unmarked grave, hide it in my bony jaw, the place where my tongue would be if it had not rotted away. Dare I say that it is your ignorance, madam, that lines my pocket, gives me entry into the lesser rooms of your house, allows my touch to enter you in the most intimate of ways. Madam, please, do not forget that every morsel that slides down your dewy white throat has first rested in my 2 hands, coddled in the warmth of my 10 fingers. If there is a secret, madam, it is this. Nutmeg. I lie. An important disclosure, they always think. They all believe in a secret ingredient, a balm for their Gallic pride, a magic elixir that anyone can employ to duplicate my success. Its existence downplays my skills, cheapens my worth. Its very existence threatens my own. If there is a secret, madam, it is this. Repetition and routine, servitude and subservience, beck and call. While you have been waking up to the aroma of coffee brewing, dressing to the hushed rhythm of other people's labor, I have been in the kitchen since I was 6, and in your kitchen since 6 this morning. In my life as a minor domestic, a bit character in your daily dramas, I have prepared thousands of omelets. Miss Toklas places the omelet, the curved edges still humming heat before Gertrude Stein, a song of temptation falling on tone-deaf ears. Gertrude Stein will not touch the food until it has dropped to the temperature of the dining room. Tepid, my madam thinks, is best. Tepid is also for Gertrude Stein, a delectable dose of revenge, because Miss Toklas is happiest when her meals are consumed while hot, with thick tendrils of steam reaching up, catching her hair, and dangling earrings. She insists on nothing less for those who sit at her table. She demands even more for Gertrude Stein. Miss Toklas believes that with every meal, she serves a part of herself, an exquisite metaphor garnishing every plate. Gertrude Stein knows that for every minute that she indulges, Miss Toklas suffers a little death. Worse, rejection enters the room and threatens to steal Miss Toklas's chair. Gertrude Stein, in this way, extracts satisfaction for every indignity that she has suffered at the hands of Miss Toklas. Most recently, there was the banishment of cream and lard from their diet for 6 miserable months. The exile of salt, the expatriation of alcohol, the expulsion of cigarettes, these were the other brutal regimes that came and went, trampling mercilessly on my madame's will. Retribution comes to Gertrude Stein in a form so passive, potent, and cruel that it could subsist only between two lovers. This morning, like all the others, I am expected to prepare a plate of sautéed chicken livers for Basket and Pépé, after I have fully attended to their madames, of course. At 27 Rue de Flores, as elsewhere, the order of things is very important. Pink on the inside and moist, but no blood should run when they are pressed with a fork, were Miss Toklas's precise instructions. A splash of cognac, madame? I was tempted to, but did not ask. I prepare one plate for each dog. These two are absolutely unwilling to share. Basket, the poodle, responds to all objects of excitement with uncontrolled, uninhibited wetness, which signals that he is pleased. At first, Pepe the Chihuahua responded to the sight of his breakfast being drowned by backing away and skulking onto Miss Toklas's lap. I can say one thing for these dogs. They know who favors them. Because not long after that pathetic display, I received orders to prepare for Pepe his very own plate. My liver-stuffed dogs is what I call Basket and Pepe when their madames are not around. I say it in Vietnamese. I always speak to Basket and Pepe in Vietnamese. Believe me, liver-stuffed dogs sounds much lovelier in Vietnamese than in French. Fatten up is what I whisper to Basket and Pepe when I serve them their morning meals. Tasty, I always think. No wonder Basket and Pepe abhor me. They know that I would rather serve them than serve them. Basket and Pepe know what I mean, and they also know how best to punish me. Every morning, Basket insists on breaking his fast underneath the very center of the dining table as opposed to his favored position by Gertrude Stein's feet. He does it so that I will have to get on my knees and crawl toward him with my livers in one hand and my dignity in the other.
Monique Trong is the author of The Book of Salt. The lines are officially open. You can reach us at 800-537-5252, and we will talk. Okay, let's get right to the phones. We have Mike on the line. So, Mike, what pressing issue
do you want to talk about?
Hi, Lynn. It's great to talk to you. I'm a big fan of the Splendid Table. I get to hear it on WETA and WHYY.
Hey, thank you.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to hearing it in full digital when you convert it to radio someday. But in the meantime, I want to talk to you about grilling fish.
Grilling fish. Okay.
Now, I do grill fish. What I would like to do is recreate this really fabulous taste and texture that I had once in Redondo Beach, California. It was almost a crispy outside crust without
right.
being breaded. It was more like peppers, like a blackened redfish type of consistency without being quite that far down that road.
Right.
And the inside was very firm, not watery type of fish.
Mm-hmm.
And I haven't the slightest idea how to go about this. I'm thinking that I could probably get if I started with the right kind of fish, I could mix up different kinds of ground peppers and garlic and salt, and get the crust by using
right.
a blackening style. But I mean really really hot iron.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly.
I don't know what fish to start with.
Well, you know, the whole business when blackened fish started with Paul Prudhomme in New Orleans, the Cajun business, because he's the man who started it. He was using redfish. He was using, if I remember, red snapper. And that wiped out a lot of the red snapper supply around the world because it became so popular. Anything in the snapper family is going to be firm. Anything in the bass family will be pretty firm. Let me think now. Because you also want something that has some robust quality behind it as well. And that's important. Halibut. Haddock, a little flakier, but still could hold up well. Where do you live?
East Coast.
East Coast.
Yeah, New York area.
You know the thing that occurs to me? It's, striped bass. And again, any of the bass family. Because as I remember, there's a lot of striped bass in that part of the world. The other thing might be bluefish. Bluefish is stronger in flavor, but it can stand up to that kind of seasoning. And I think of it as a medium-bodied fish, you know, not super firm, but pretty decent. So that's where I'd begin, okay? Bass family, bluefish, anything that has snapper in the name. John Dory, if you can get it, is another one that would work in this particular situation. And then the seasoning, I think you're right. Start working with chilies and with peppers blends. The other thing to consider is, could that fish have been deep fried in a batter?
No.
Okay. All right. Okay.
I pulled it out and looked at it.
No, I think then I think you're absolutely on to the right thing. And those are the fish to think about. And I'm sorry, I know there's more. Tilefish is another one.
Tilefish?
Generally, tilefishes range from being very cheap to suddenly being the new darling. I'd go for the very cheap version.
Okay.
And tilapia may be another choice.
Well, I had some a while back and it was fabulous.
Yeah. Yeah. And but remember, if you're going to do a really strong seasoning, you want a fish that's going to hold up to it.
Yeah. Mm. Okay.
Okay. Hey, so take care.
My mouth's watering all
Yeah,
day.
Mine is too.
Right.
You take care.
Thank you. Thank
you
very much.
You are welcome.
Bye-bye.
Goodbye. Well, it's time for our weekly trivia challenge. Now, here's the question. This is for you Asia buffs or perhaps scholars. It is about a style of dining in Japan. What is Niotaimori? Now, we're going to have that answer in a moment, and we're going to be back to your calls. You can reach us at 800-537-5252. I'm Lynn Rossetto-Casper. You're listening to The Splendid Table, produced by Minnesota Public Radio and distributed by Public Radio International.
Thank you.
I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper, and this is The Splendid Table, the show for people who love to eat. The Splendid Table is brought to you by Super Target. It's Target, now available in food, where you can find the expected and unexpected aisle after aisle. Online at target.com/supertarget. Now, we'll be getting back to your calls in a moment. You can get to us at 800-537-5252. But first, I've got the answer to this week's trivia challenge. Now, the question was, what is Niotaimori? Well, the answer is Niotaimori is a feast eaten off of the body of a naked woman. Talk about presentation being everything. The food is cold, thank goodness, and it's usually sushi-style dishes. Now, every source I have found states that the woman must shave, wax, and lie absolutely still for up to 8 hours. Guests pay up to $1,200 to attend a Niotaimori feast, and hopefully most of that goes to the centerpiece. Now, the two big questions here are, who would want to be a dinner plate, and who wants to eat off of bare skin? But I don't think we're going to go there. Just in case you think this is some kind of ancient cultural ritual, hence deserves reverence, it isn't. Evidently, Niotaimori was a gimmick dreamed up by a restaurateur to attract more customers. And the novelty is wearing off in Japan. But it is becoming popular in Scandinavia and, of all places, Italy. Never underestimate the power of the gimmick. Okay, back to the phones. You can get to us at 800-537-5252. We've got Vincent on the line. Vincent, what do you want to talk about? What's on your mind?
I'd like to talk about eggplants, particularly roasting and grilling the things.
All right.
I like to, particularly in the summer, barbecue or I should say grill or roast eggplants on the barbecue grill.
Mm-hmm.
And most of the instructions, particularly in older cookbooks, call for simply pricking the grilled eggplant several times and then slapping it on the grill and letting it cook till it's soft.
Right.
Every time I do that, I end up with this bitter, unpalatable mush that just is not very good at all. The only way I know to get that bitter taste out is to salt it.
Yeah.
But
that defeats because you're trying to make something that would be an eggplant puree.
More or less. I've gotten around it by peeling the eggplant, salting it, and then wrapping it in foil to protect it from the heat, but then I lose some of the flavor from the skin.
Mm-hmm.
Is there a happy medium that I can strike?
You know, I have to be honest with you. I have lousy eggplant karma. No, but then I felt vindicated, because, you know, you really feel like a wimp, especially in this business, when you say you have no luck with eggplant.
Uh-huh.
And I was talking with James Peterson. He's done this big book on vegetables.
Mm-hmm.
And James is one of those people that never gives up when he's researching something. And he's a consummate cook and technician.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, I had the same problem. And he said, what I discovered is it isn't us. It could be the eggplant.
I see.
And his suggestion was to use Japanese eggplants. You know those long eggplants? They're in a lot.
Oh, yes.
You know,
I'm very familiar with them.
Yeah, and they're in a lot of farmers markets. A lot of people are growing them.
Mm-hmm.
They tend to not be as bitter. And what you're making by grilling it slowly and getting the char on the outside of the skin and the eggplant collapses on itself
mm-hmm.
is essentially, if we were in some parts of the Middle East, what you make from that puree inside of the eggplant, because it actually turns to mush with garlic and olive oil or sesame,
mm-hmm.
is called baba ganoush.
Yes.
If you do it by adding more sesame or adding vegetable oil and garlic, it's called at least my Jewish friend calls it pot légel.
Mm-hmm.
But you need the char and you need the roasting. And you're right, the salting defeats it.
Mm-hmm.
I would say forget the globe eggplants. You and I were born with a genetic structure that the globe eggplant will never be happy in our presence. This is technically true. I can
uh-huh.
I have not I don't have scientific research to back this, but someday someone will research this. And
no
this
doubt.
And what I would do, go out and buy those long eggplants and see they're sweeter.
Mm-hmm.
Just see what ends up, because I think you'll end up having much more success with them.
I'll give that a try. Yeah, one of my favorite dishes with that particular technique is called kiopulu. It's a Bulgarian variant with tomatoes and roasted peppers and onions.
Oh, that sounds well. You mix that soft eggplant mush wonderfulness mm-hmm. with roasted peppers and onions.
Roasted peppers. peppers, onions, and roasted tomatoes.
Oh,
it's all,
brother.
It's one step away from a puree.
Oh, God, that sounds fabulous.
One step away.
All right, that's what I'm doing this weekend. Off to the farmer's market. Hey, thanks.
Hey, you're welcome.
Another recipe. I love this.
I got a million of them.
Oh, boy. Keep calling, kid.
I will.
Goodbye.
Bye.
That sounds fabulous. Roast all of it at once on the grill. So you could roast slices of onion, you could roast the whole tomato, maybe slip off the skin afterward. And then you could roast some garlic, and you could roast the peppers. And then you slow roast the eggplant. That would go on first. And then you put it all together. Hey, and you serve that at room temperature? Oh, boy. Put that on fish? Yeah, okay. You can call us. I'll stop now. 800-537-5252. We have Raquel on the line. Hey, Raquel.
Hi, Lynn.
What do you want to talk about?
I'm from Michigan, and I recently went up north this weekend to the Traverse City Cherry Festival. And right now in my fridge, I have about, well, I had 15 pounds, but I've been eating them all week. So now I have close to 10. We have close to 10 pounds now. We have 10 pounds of wonderful Traverse City cherries.
A mere bagatelle, right?
Yes.
Of cherries, just 10 pounds.
Yeah. Yeah. We kind of overdid it picking the cherries this year, I think. There wasn't any last year. But I was wondering if you had any recipe that's easy, something different besides pies, jellies, jam, fruit salad, all that kind of stuff.
Well, you know, one thing you can do with them is stem and all, even, is put them in brandy.
Put them in brandy?
Yeah, and then they become Christmas gifts.
Oh, so they last?
Oh, yeah. Oh, you pickle that in alcohol, and let me tell you, they're going to last for a year or more.
Wow.
This is what you do, all right? You have to sterilize jars. You know, you can get jars. You can get anything that has a wide enough top on it that people can easily pull out the cherries. So you get a bunch of jars, you put them in boiling water, you handle them with tongs. You know, the idea is that if you sterilize the jar, you don't stick your fingers in it. Okay. So sterilize your jars, and they should have lids that fit fairly tightly.
Mm-hmm.
And then you mix together equal parts of sugar and water. Okay. Cool. So like 1 cup sugar to 1 cup water.
Mm-hmm.
And you throw a couple of vanilla beans in that mixture. That you slit. I'm giving you the sexy version of the brandied cherries. And you let that boil until it's clear. Don't stir it. Just let it simmer on the stove. It's going to take a few minutes. Get it completely cooled down. And then you put a little bit of that in the bottom of each jar. So let's say the jar is 4 inches high, for argument's sake. You want to have about a half inch of the syrup. All right? Then you go out and you buy brandy. Now, it does not have to be great brandy. It can be an inexpensive California brandy.
Mm-hmm.
Because a great brandy, that's nice, but you're looking for the cherry flavor getting into the brandy.
Mm-hmm.
So a great brandy, you'll be throwing your money away.
Right.
So now what you're going to do is you're going to pack your really well-washed cherries into that jar. And you are going to add brandy. Now, you want to pack the cherries and leave about a half inch at the top so that they're always covered in brandy. You put the lid on and you turn the jar upside down. You just turn the jar around a couple of times. You know, the idea is you're blending those things. Put it in a cool, dark place. And within a couple of weeks, you're going to have brandy cherries, but they'll keep for a year.
Wow.
And then you can take those cherries out and you can put them in drinks and whatever, but they're wonderful on things like ice cream or cake or panna cotta.
Mm-hmm.
And you can actually take that brandy and you can drizzle it over things to flavor it. But the other thing you can do with the brandy is you put it in tiny glasses and you sip it with the cherries.
Right.
And everyone smiles.
Wow.
This is such a happy thing that you can do for friends, I can't tell you.
Wow.
Okay, so that's one thing. You can preserve the cherries that way. It's so easy.
Mm-hmm.
There's absolutely nothing to it.
Wow, okay.
10 pounds.
Yeah.
You're going to take care of everybody on your holiday list.
I think so.
Hey, Raquel, thanks.
Thank you.
Take care.
Yep.
Bye. Cherries are probably one of the most sensual things. I mean, they're juicy and they're succulent. I think of them as the mini filet mignons of the fruit world. Ugh. 10 pounds in the refrigerator. Wish it were me. 800-537-5252. We have Chicky calling. Chicky, what's up? What do you want to talk about?
Hello, Lynn. How are you?
I am good.
Excellent. Last week, I went to the farmer's market, and while I was there, I saw a woman with these beautiful, beautiful greens that were green on the outside and had this beautiful purple color coming up from the vein on the inside. And I asked her, I was like, what is this? And she was like, it's amaranth. And I was like, well, how do you cook it? And she was like, we grow it and we sell it, but we don't use it. So I had heard of amaranth, the grain being used for different things, but yeah. I'd never heard of the leaves. So I went back and checked all my cookbooks, checked online, even uh-huh. called my mom, and we had no idea how to use it. So Lynn, you're my last hope. What can I do?
You've hit the bottom of the barrel, and now you're praying. I understand. What you have is something called red amaranth, and it's stunningly beautiful. Whenever I come across it, it ends up in a jug in the dining room or in the kitchen for a day or so just because it's so pretty. I mean, it'll wilt really fast, but treat it like spinach. And in Asia, it is treasured, especially Southeast Asia. Okay? So now think about this for a second, all right? Think if you had young spinach, what would you do with it? Well, if you like spicy, all right, what you would do with it is stir fry it. You'd take some ginger and garlic. You know, you'd heat a wok or just a big saute pan. Put a little bit of vegetable oil in it. Saute equal parts of ginger, fresh ginger, and garlic, and then take a ton of those leaves. You have to really wash them and dry them well because they get very sandy. Okay? And you'd throw that into the pan and saute it until it wilts. And then add a couple of tablespoons of oyster sauce, Chinese oyster sauce. Yeah. And it comes in small bottles, you know, because oyster sauce, you buy a lot of oyster sauce and you're going to have it for years. But a couple of tablespoons of that with a few tablespoons of sugar and, of course, salt and pepper. And simmer that until it's just boiled down and you'll have this wonderful, the leaves have that spinach quality, but there's a meatier edge to them than spinach. So think of stir fries. Think of stewing them, you know, just sauteing them in a little bit of oil with lemongrass and garlic and ginger, and then adding a little bit of water and just letting that cook down.
Okay. I had been in the Peace Corps as well, and they had a leaf that kind of looked like the red amaranth, but they used to cook it in a peanut sauce. Do you think that would work as
where,
well?
Where were you in the Peace Corps?
I was in Cameroon, West Africa.
You know what? It would be fabulous in a peanut sauce because it stands up nicely to spices.
Mm-hmm.
And what did they do? They took a leaf that they stewed it in the peanut sauce?
Basically, yeah. They soaked theirs for a while, though. They did several washings of it because they called it bitter leaf.
Uh-huh.
Like
uh-huh.
The translation was bitter leaf.
It may not have been amaranth, but it's going to certainly, amaranth would probably take to it very nicely.
Oh, excellent.
Well, oh, great.
Thank you so much.
Hey, thank you.
Okay, take care.
You too.
Bye-bye.
If you've never seen amaranth, it is a fairly sizable leaf, and it has this purple, magenta, almost red stem that then the red goes into the veins of the green leaf. It is stunning. It is beautiful. What might be fun is put a bouquet of it in the center of the table and then serve the rest of it cooked. A decoration. That kind of thing. Well, the big news is that the Chippewa Valley Ethanol Company in Benson, Minnesota, is taking on the Russians. They are making vodka. Well, we have General Manager Bill Lee on the phone. Bill, thanks for talking with us.
Well, thank you, Lynn.
Now, can you remind us what ethanol actually is?
Well, ethanol is an alcohol that is fermented out of grains or starchy material. And ethanol has been around for tens of thousands of years that man's been making ethanol products.
But you're proposing to put ethanol in our car gas tanks, right?
Well, there's a lot of ethanol produced in the United States for fuel, as a fuel additive right now. But there's a lot of ethanol is also part of spirits and beer and wine manufacture.
So you're turning ethanol now into vodka?
This project we're working on here to make the Shaker's vodka obviously is for human consumption. And we're not only taking on the Russians, the Swedes, and the French as well.
Oh, You don't pick anything small, do you?
Well, you know, this is America. We're very proud of of our grain. We think we, particularly here in Minnesota, we think we grow some of the finest wheat in the world. And we have taken that wheat and crafted a very special world-class vodka product.
Now, you are right in the middle of the grain fields up there, right, in Benson, Minnesota.
Oh, yes.
So are local farmers part of this whole thing? I mean, is this like a cooperative of farmers that are doing this?
Absolutely. We are a cooperative. We have about 850 members here, and this cooperative was formed so that the growers could create a little more value in their product.
So what does Shaker's Vodka sell for?
Well, the prices here in Minnesota vary from maybe around $30 a bottle to $33.
Is it sold nationwide?
It's available across the nation in limited distribution right now, and that is we're in the process of rolling this out to a lot of sites.
Yeah, where does the name come from? Because when I think of Shakers, I think of that community, utopian community, and I don't think they drank very much.
No, you're right. This is the Shaker's name relates to cocktail shakers. And the cocktail shaker was an American invention, and you could say that the cocktail was one of America's profound contributions to world culture.
Okay, and now Benson, Minnesota is making another profound contribution.
Well, you know, we've got a very very promising start with the reception to this product so far.
Well, we're going to have to try it. And Bill, thanks for talking with us.
Thank you so much.
Bill Lee is general manager of the Chippewa Valley Ethanol Company in Benson, Minnesota. The vodka they make is called Shakers. You can find information on the website, splendidtable.org. Well, that's the show for this week, everybody. Thanks for joining us. Remember, you can call us anytime. Number's 800-537-5252. And until next week, let me leave you with this thought from A.J. Liebling. He said, vodka, which of course has no color, no taste, and no smell, is the ideal intoxicant for the drinker who wants no reminder of how hurt mother would be if she knew what he was doing. The Splendid Table is brought to you by SuperTarget. You can find everything you heard here and so much more on our website, splendidtable.org. And while you're visiting, don't miss out on our free newsletter. It's called Weeknight Kitchen, and we hope it helps make your weeknight cooking a little easier. You register for it online at splendidtable.org. Our producer is Sally Swift, with help from Jennifer Russell. Our technical director is Jennifer Lubke. Our website is managed by Sarah Lear and Judy Graham. The Splendid Table is produced by Minnesota Public Radio and distributed nationwide by Public Radio International. Have a great week. Join us next time. And thanks for tuning in. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper.
PRI, Public Radio International.